Hello, everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. In case you don't know by now, my name is Chris Denson, and this show covers all things marketing, innovation, ideas, whatever we can find in the marketplace that we think is interesting and awesome. And the ball does not stop today. Hello, Tristan Walker. How
What's
are you?
What's going on?
How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good.
Good, good, good. Good is good.
That's for sure.
Hopefully, I'm going to get to great. That's what I'm trying to get to. I'm going to be doing, get my Tony the Tiger on.
I hear that.
So let's you know, I doubt if there aren't very many people who know who you are, especially when it comes to my audience, all 11 of them. But why don't you give us a little bit of the 101 on who Tristan is?
Yeah. So, you know, I can go as far back as you want, but most recently, you know, I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Walker & Company. You know, we develop, you know, health and beauty brands specifically tailored to the needs of people of color. Kind of before I founded this company, I worked at Foursquare, mobile social application, pretty early at that company, and helped that on the business team kind of grow to what it is today. And yeah, man, just, you know, I'm a dad.
Congratulations. that's a newly appointed post, right?
Yeah, man. He's 3.5 months, and he's as good as I could have ever imagined, man. Like, I love that little guy.
That's great. Yeah. Well, you should love him. I think you're legally required to.
Well, yeah.
So, no, I actually just did a second birthday for my son. So, so if you need any tips, let me know.
Have you hit the terrible twos yet?
Yeah. You know, yes. Yes. Okay. It is a terrible, you know, and I'm not big on like cliches or like, oh, you know, oh, the kids do this and people do that. Like, I'm like, no, we got this. But sure enough, that dude is kicking and screaming and refuses to sleep and throws his food on the floor. I'm like, if you're a grown man, this would be fighting territory.
Yeah, but enjoying it till then.
Yeah, so yeah, you got about I can't do math. You got 21 more months, so so good luck. So how does one make the, you know, make the leap from a Foursquare, which you, like you said, is social mobile, and we all know sort of what Foursquare is thanks to you, to like a, you know, a consumer product, you know, line, and a suite of them at that.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't much of a change. Quite frankly, you know, I get that question all the time, right? But at the end of the day, you know, Foursquare was about building a brand that people love with an app that was actually pretty useful, so a product that was useful and solved a need, right? When we think about what we're doing at Walker & Company, specifically our first brand, Bevel, you know, it's building a brand that people love with a product that works and a product that people need, right? The only difference is I'm not dealing in like bits and bytes anymore. It's actual like real product, right? So yeah, you know, I've been very fortunate and blessed to like have, at least in my opinion, that like seamlessness. But as far as like how I actually did it, like tactically, you know, I left Foursquare. I felt it was time to go out and you know, start a new company. I was very proud of what we did at Foursquare, but I felt it was time, and there were bigger problems that needed to be solved. And I felt as good a time as any to try. Joined a venture capital firm in Andreessen Horowitz as an entrepreneur in residence. So, you know, that pretty much meant I had 6 to 9 months to figure out the company I wanted to start, which is like the best job ever.
That's right? That's a great gig.
Yeah, it was crazy. So I spent all 9 months there naturally to figure it out. 7 months into it, I came up with the concept for Walker & Company, and the rest is history. You raised $10 million for it, et cetera. But, you know, the transition wasn't as jaded as I thought it would be originally. It was actually, you know, a lot of the same learnings we learned from Foursquare and kind of we're applying here.
Let's make that a practical leap there, right? Where, you know, what are some of the tactics that you did apply? You know, I get it in terms of attracting an audience, you know, examining a product feature sets and functionality and so on and so forth. What are some of the other like things that paralleled and kind of propelled you into,
well,
you know,
the only thing matters, right, is like building something that people want to talk about, right? So, you know, it begs the question, how do you build things that people want to talk about? You make a product that works, right? And once you make a product that works, kind of treats the consumer in a way that's respectful, right? Right? And it boils down to just the kind of time, practicality, and math in a lot of cases.
Right.
So, you know, we started the Bevel brand. We raised money, I think it was May of 2013 now. And then we started taking orders 6 months later, right, with no prior experience at all in consumer packaged goods. Usually, you know, people who want to start new brands, it takes 18, 24 months, right? We did it in six. And that was just a function of it just being not necessarily easy to do or simple to do, but it wasn't rocket science, right? And it really was steeped in this kind of idea that, you know, we just want to develop something that people wanted, right? So at its core, and it might seem abstract, but it's really not. You know, you just got to make something that people are willing to talk about, and that's a function of just building something that people need.
Nice. Good job. so far. No. And so, I mean, I wanted to back up a second ago, because, you know, I think as an entrepreneur in residence, as an entrepreneur in general, as, you know, someone who built up a company like Foursquare, what was your predictive filter, right? Because you, from what I've learned, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you know, you kind of knocked on the door of Foursquare asking to do this, you know, the biz dev for them. So what was it about Foursquare that attracted you and that you saw success and a trajectory that, you know, most of us probably don't have that same spider sense?
Yeah. So I think it started with, identifying the things that'll change my life, right? Even before Foursquare, I joined Twitter when there were about 20 people at the company, and I think they had like a million users at the time, is something like that. And, you know, like I saw at the time that they were just changing communication, right? Like I had a few experiences with Twitter that were just magical. Same thing happened at Foursquare, right? I joined Foursquare when we had 10, 15 at the time, and it really changed the way I thought about like exploring my city, right? Like, and I want to be a part of things that change my life first, right? And there are a lot of people like me, right? So if something is naturally changing my life, like we'll be changing it for a good portion of people, right? A good number of people. And then the same applied for Walker & Company and Bevel, right? I wanted to build something that would fundamentally change my life. And, you know, a lot of, you know, I've been blessed to be able to find kind of those companies in this one as well. So, you know, that's a, you know, a big kind of part of it as well. You know, luck is a factor, quite frankly. But also, like, it really doesn't, like, I wanted to join companies that I was so enamored with that I'd be willing to work with them even if they didn't give me a job.
Right.
And that was a function of kind of my just love for its ability to change my life, right?
Which is also risky.
Like, I mean, it's not necessarily risky because if look at it this way, right? I will have spent 2 years, let's say it lasted 2 years and didn't work out. I will have spent 2 years working on something that fundamentally changed my life. How many people get to do that?
True.
Right?
True.
And, you know, at the end of the day, like I fundamentally believe in, you know, my own personal ability to, you know, get out and, you know, try to do important things or find those opportunities, sprinkle with a little bit of faith, right?
Right.
And kind of that combination just, you know, it's pretty deadly.
And, you know, and sort of you've got a pretty good batting average, right?
we'll see.
Well, no, you know, I mean, you've got I'm predicting. How about that?
I'll take it.
But no, I think when there are a lot of startups, there are a lot of people with ideas in their back pocket or, you know, at some stage of development, and they all believe in them, you know, when do you know that? So I get that you see it as a personal use to you, but I think a lot of people do that, right? You know, one idea that I have, I actually want to do, is called the Museum of Bad Ideas, right? Where it's, you take a physical space and you've got like everything that didn't work that people thought would work.
Yeah.
And, you know, is like, how do you, what's that mechanic, right?
Here's the thing, right? Like, what I had some good advice from this from Ben Horowitz, and he was like, Tristan, what usually looks like a good idea is a bad idea. What usually looks like a bad idea is a good idea. You know, probably in that museum of bad ideas, they're like, the majority of them are actually good ideas, right? And his point in saying that is, if there's an idea that looks good, there's probably 1,000 other people working on that same idea, right? So there's really no value creation there. Usually the innovation happens in the ideas that actually look bad on the surface, right? You know, a perfect example is like Airbnb. Who would have ever imagined, right, that folks would just rent out kind of their rooms to strangers, right? Yes. Now it's a multi-billion dollar business, right? Yep. Same with Facebook. Who would have imagined that people would put all of their information on the internet, right? Now it's a many tens and hundreds of billions of dollar company, right? So, you know, sure, you can say that I have like a good batting average, but at the end of the day, like, you really don't know what's going to end up being a good idea, bad idea. So, but what I do know are the things that will fundamentally change my life and the things that I'm going to enjoy doing regardless of the outcome, right?
Right.
And with that, like, with that mindset, you get a bit fearless, and then it just boils down to execution.
That's great. You spent your entrepreneurial residency, you know, you said 7 months it took you.
Yeah.
So the other 6 months was probably filled with some things that you, for whatever reasons, chose that you decided that they would not increase your batting average. What were some of the things that came out of, you know, that were filtered through, and what were some of the filtering processes, you know, some of the deciding factors that you said, okay, this idea is great or bad, according to you and Ben's theory, but it's not good enough, right?
Yeah, so you know, there's a difference between good and bad versus like things that are right for you, right? So even the ideas that I came up with in those first 7 months, they weren't bad. I just wasn't the right person for them, right? You know, I had an idea I wanted to fix childhood obesity, right? I had an idea to fix freight and trucking in the country. Like, are very, very sizable opportunities that someone is going to do and succeed wildly at, right? I just wasn't the right guy for it. Couple that with the fact that, like, I go around and pitch my ideas to a lot of these other venture capitalists in those arenas, and they say, you know, Tristan, that's an amazing idea, amazing idea, amazing idea. And I pitch it to Ben, and he'd be like, yeah, I don't know, right? And then it wasn't until I came up with the idea for Walker Company that I'd go and pitch it to everybody, and they'd be like, no, I don't think that that's the right idea, I don't understand it. And Ben would be like, that's the one, right? And, you know, through that experience, I realized how much in the first 7 months I was trying to build something to make other people happy, right? As opposed to just not giving a crap what people think about me and doing the thing that I felt uniquely positioned to do.
I like that. I like that a lot. Is it lonely at the top?
I don't know.
Right? You're there. No, but you know, really interesting read in Fast Company last month. And I say that jokingly, but I also, you know, when I read this article about diversity in Silicon Valley, it's a 15-page spread on you and your experience, and it does feel very isolated, right? Do you feel that, or does it sort of not manifest, and especially as you know, the result of your residency being a product for people of color, you know, what are some of the dynamics and things that you face, or does it, is it kind of like water off a duck's back?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, the way I think about it, there are three things that are important to me, right? First, my faith. Second is my family. And last is like my work, right? And the colleagues that I work with, et cetera. Just with those three things, I'm never going to get lonely, right? Like, I'm very, very happy. It takes up a lot of my time, and it's time well spent, right? So from like a kind of loneliness perspective, no, right? I feel very fulfilled in that regard. From the perspective of like, you know, Walker & Company and building something that a lot of people don't understand, you know, I see kind of potential greatness in that, right? You know, any of the greatest, largest innovations were the same ways, right? And, you know, it's not lonely because I have plenty of customers that are finding benefit in what we do, right? So it's like a shared collective kind of like sigh of relief that someone cares enough to actually care, right? And as long as kind of folks look at us and kind of the brands that we launch to deliver on that care promise, you know, like I'll never get lonely, bored, right? Not excited about what we're doing. We're well on our way to do something pretty special.
That's awesome. And then, you know, when you talk about that collective sigh of relief, right, you've created this product. Kind of walk us through some of the particulars of Bevel, you know, the first of what I imagine and hope to be many products that you put out. But just, you know, both through, because I feel like from a brand standpoint, I mean, and I mean that from pure branding, right, the color schemes, the products and ingredients, the way it's gets distributed to the customer. Kind of walk us through some of your thinking and some of the particulars behind the product.
Yeah, so Bevel is the first and only kind of shaving system designed specifically for men and women with kind of coarse curly hair, right? You think about issues related to shaving irritation, razor bumps, all that stuff. It's a problem that 80% of Black folks have, and then 30% of folks of other kind of racist colors have, right? It's a big problem. It's a big global problem, right? And no one's tried to solve it. And the people who've tried have delivered products that just either don't work or hazardous for you, among other things, right? So taking that, we said, all right, we need to develop a clinically proven solution that works, right? No one's going to buy our products, however we distribute it or design it, if the product doesn't work, right? So we went to actually develop proprietary formulations that are clinically proven to work. So check that box. Secondly, the thing that we, wanted to really win on is really no longer anybody having the experience of walking down an aisle, picking up a package with like a 67-year-old dude in jerry curls with like a velvet robe drinking a cognac on the packaging, right? Like that stuff was just absolutely ridiculous.
So you've seen me shopping is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, going through that my entire life just sucks. And it's a damn shame, right?
No, I know. I've been there.
But what's even more interesting about that whole experience is that that packaging hasn't changed over decades, which means that they're probably making a hell of a lot of money to not have to care, right?
Right.
And then lastly, I kind of talk about this quote that Johnny Ive at Apple said at a Vanity Fair conference a few months ago, and it stuck with me for a while. And he said, consumers can discern carelessness for a product just as much as they can discern care for one. And when we think about like our experiences with products, we think a lot about the carelessness, right? This product sucks, right?
Right.
For this reason, this reason, this reason. And we don't really talk about all the things that really good, well, like designed products like do to show the care that they have for it, right? So I'll give you a perfect example. And this drives a lot of what we do for Bevel. We do things like you get our box, like you get a handwritten note from me, like welcoming you to the family, right? Like I can outsource that if I wanted to, but no, you get a handwritten note from me, like because that stuff matters, right? Secondly, you think about just the box design that we have. It takes like 2.5 seconds to lift off the top from the base, right? Just to build that anticipation for what's underneath. And considering like our customer set, many of whom are shaving for the first time or the second time because the first time they use something else and it sucks, like we want to deliver that entire intimate experience that's beautiful, anticipatory, among other things, right? We also do things like video one-on-one interviews for people who either want to kind of learn how to do it the right way the first time or have had problems with other products and really want to learn a little bit more about what we do, right? These are things that don't necessarily scale. You travel internationally, you really can't go with Blaze, but we'll ship Blaze to your destination, right? Free of charge, right? That's care for a product.
That's awesome.
Right. So we want to make sure that we're delivering on those things consistently. And I think that's a big reason why people look at the Bevel brand and like, wow, like that's kind of what we've had for or what we've wanted for a while. And then the very last thing I want to say, I believe this to be very true. And I challenge everybody to really think about this because I think it's profound and right. I'm 30 years old and like I reflect back on my life and I've really never had a brand that I was proud to support. Right? Like there are a lot of products I like using, right? When I look at the brand, like there's no brand I'm like, wow, like I'm actually proud to support that brand. And I feel like that wasn't the case when my mom was growing up with like the Soft Sheens of the world, the Soul Trains, like all that stuff, but how do we like engender the next generation of that? And I think Walker Company is like primarily positioned to do that. And that is like a little bit of the kind of secret special sauce that people don't give us enough credit for. But the company that is that company to inspire pride in its customers will have a very, very important company.
Well, I mean, and kudos to you for the level of care you've taken in checking all the boxes and creating some new ones. I like to think around this idea of design thinking. right? Mm-hmm. Where, you know, you're starting with the customer first and not mm-hmm. the product or not the business. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's pretty awesome. Were there any other companies you took cues from? Like the first one that came to mind for me as you were talking is like a Zappos, right? And mm-hmm. they, from a business standpoint, they talk about themselves being a customer service company that happens to sell, you know, sell products.
Yeah.
And so the customer service always comes first. Were there any other, you know, who else did you take cues from? Especially, you know, like you said, not having that generationally or culturally to look at.
Yeah, so there are two ways to think about that. Number one is like the brand side. Two is just the tactical execution. A company that I think a lot about is just Amazon, which, funny enough, owns Zappos, right? And, you know, Amazon has this really ambitious goal to be the world's most consumer-centric company, period, right? You know, I think about, you know, what we're doing in terms of being the most consumer-centric, like, health and beauty products company. I think we can do it. And with Amazon, Jeff Bezos did this really great thing to help him think about, like, how his business works. And he kind of wrote on the napkin this concept of a flywheel, right? So, you know, flywheels is a very heavy kind of, like, spinning thing that, like, once you – it takes a lot of kind of work to get it started. But if you keep spinning, like, it's just going to keep going, and it takes a lot of force to stop it, right? So he thought about the flywheel starting with customer satisfaction, right? You build an experience that people love, like, they'll want to talk about it, and that'll drive traffic to your site, right? If you get more people kind of coming to your site, you're going to get more third-party sellers to want to sell on your platform. If you get more third-party sellers selling on your platform, you're going to get greater selection, right? If you get greater selection, you're going to just drive more customer satisfaction, right? Like, I can buy more stuff from one place. That's going to drive this, like, flywheel of revenue growth, right? Once that's spinning, out of that revenue growth, you're able to kind of lower costs on the kind of supply chain side, right? And then what do you do with those lower costs? You just pass that through to consumer in terms of lower prices, which drives customer satisfaction, right? So if you look over the past 20 years, the reason why Amazon's been able to dominate and do so well relative to brick and mortar incumbents is because they thought about their business in terms of that flywheel that's hard to stop. You know, when I think about Walker Company, you know, we start with customer satisfaction as well. So whether you call it Zappos or Amazon, like, you know, we take that very, very, very seriously. Out of that customer satisfaction, we're focusing on really the most social demographic on the planet, right? So when you think about word of mouth, like, that's a rung in the flywheel that's important. With word of mouth, we'll get the traffic, right? With traffic, you're going to get more people that want to distribute our product in their store, right? So we think about that as, like, distribution. Now you have more Bevel, more Walker Company products in more places, which means customers are going to be happy that they can find it anywhere, right? Which drives our engine for revenue growth, cash growth, profitability. Out of that profitability, we can lower our costs on the supply chain side. But instead of, like, just naturally kind of going to a race to the bottom, lower costs, we think about reinvesting that into other products that solve acute health and beauty products needs for people of color, right? And with that, you drive more customer satisfaction. So for us, you know, when we think about, like, the next 20 years, you know, we think tactically about every rung in that flywheel and making that world class.
That's fantastic. It's really the intricacy of making a good brand and not just, you know, starting a business. It's two different trains of thought. I think about, you know, you've had a lot of successes, and, like, again, check those boxes. What are some of the hurdles that you faced, you know, so far? You know, was there a pothole along the way thus far? You know, how long have you actually been launched?
So we've been launched, come mid-February, we will have been a year's worth of shipping our product.
Right. Yeah. So in the past year, what's kind of been the biggest pothole that you've experienced so far?
Skepticism. So, you know, and this is something that we knew going in, right? Again, I mentioned a lot of our customers are shaving for the first time or the second time, right? Because they've all had, like, a bad experience prior.
Right.
Right. So it's like, all right, well, convince me why your product works, right? And convince a man, right, to do that. And, like, it's actually pretty hard to do.
So basically, you got the yeah right lips. You got a bunch of GIFs of people just making, like, the yeah right.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. But we've been able to cross that hurdle, right? But like our biggest focus is not necessarily on things like hypergrowth. It's about developing a product that just works, right? If we do that with a brand that's authentic and true to like our core customer base, everything, like the numbers will work themselves out. Like the score takes care of itself, right? But we just want to put everything we can on the field. So that's probably like the biggest thing, if anything, that we've experienced. But like we've kind of crossed that hurdle because people keep buying our stuff.
With a virtual business like this, I'm assuming it's virtual. How do you go about getting it in quite literally in the faces of people, right? Yeah. Have you taken this out to like any events? Are you like in barbershops or what are you, you know?
So we started with some, like 15, 20 barbershops around the country just to test out the model. It's definitely something that we're going to scale this year. Distribution, again, on the flywheel. That's a big kind of rung for us this year that we're going to work on in a big way. So, distributing Bevel in more places offline in addition to online, right? So you'll start to see more of that in the coming months. Absolutely. And outside of that, word of mouth, right, which is another rung on that flywheel. But we get that naturally from our customers, right? Because it's like, wow, I'll buy Bevel, but let me know how you like it first, right?
Right.
And we've been blessed to have like – customers who are willing to talk about it socially, in person, online, et cetera, to drive a lot of that customer acquisition for us.
Now that you're big, I'm going to just call you Big Papa for a second. Now that you're Big Papa, what's your son's name?
Avery.
That's awesome. Yeah. Okay, great. Avery. Now that you have Avery, let's go back to young Tristan. What did Tristan want to be when he was a young fellow?
That changed, man. Like young Tristan wanted to be wealthy, right? Okay. That's just the real of it all, right? Like I grew up in the projects, all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
And knew I didn't want to kind of go back.
But
to
did
that.
You, did you know what wealth was, or you just wanted a different?
I knew what being rich was,
right?
I didn't know what wealth was until I went to high school. I went to boarding school in Connecticut for high school. I got to go to school with Fords and Rockefellers and all that stuff. I went on full scholarship.
Lucky. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. And then I got to see what wealth meant, right? And that had a profound impact on like how I looked at the world. So I knew I wanted to get rich. I realized there were three ways to do it. The first was to be an actor or an athlete, and that didn't work out for me too well.
Did you try acting?
I did.
You
not
did?
Really.
Oh,
not really. I was more an athlete, so I was a basketball player.
Were you High School Musical? Like you were in the school play and on the basketball team?
I was more. I wasn't at the drama table. I was at the athlete's table. Just say that.
All right.
And then I knew, that wasn't going to work out for me because after playing basketball so much, I got kind of tired of it. And knew like the odds on that were pretty, slim to none. Then I knew, all right, well, if that's not going to work out, you can go work on Wall Street and get rich, right? I did that for about 2 years. I was a trader on Wall Street and hated it, right? I was a victim of bad culture and I didn't, I wanted to be creative for a great one, right? And then kind of having gone through those two experiences, like, man, the only things left is entrepreneurship, right?
Right.
And then kind of that realization, I applied to Stanford for business school, and fortunately got in. And then I learned Silicon Valley existed. But what I also learned was really the reasons why anybody starts a company or becomes an entrepreneur. I mean, one of my professors, Mark Leslie, he was the founder of a company called Veritas. And he said, Tristan, there are three reasons why people start a company, right? The first is to get rich, right? Which that resonated with me. I was like, oh, hurrah, right? Like, that's awesome.
Like young Tristan.
Yeah, exactly.
Ding.
The second was to build a great company. And the third is to change the world. And, he said that because, like, it's not wrong to go down any route, right? Like, they're all fine. But, like, the route that you go down is really going to dictate the type of business you build.
Right.
Right. And having spent a few years in Silicon Valley, it's gone from kind of getting rich to building a great company that will change the world. The getting wealthy thing works itself out as long as we can do it. But it's steeped in like building a great company that people can be proud of.
And it's funny. I mean, that's an age-old spiritual, philosophical, metaphysical philosophy of do good and the wealth, I use quotation fingers, will come, right? Because wealth means a lot outside of financial wealth. Like there's a lot to be had by doing good first.
Absolutely.
Where do you see, what do you see the impact you know, not just the business piece of Bevel, but where do you see the world changing impact of a company like Bevel, or even just what you're doing, you know, as the.
Yeah, I mean, look, I say the greatest economic opportunity of my lifetime, whether that be for profit or not for profit, and I'm exhausting all of my time, resources, efforts to this on the for profit and not for profit side, is really thinking about the demographic shift happening in this country. Right. The folks of color, the majority of the country, let alone the majority of the world, but let's just talk about like the country right now. In 20, 30 years, it'll be the majority of the country. And you think about global culture, I think all global culture is led by American culture, which is led by Black culture in the U.S. and more recently Latino Asian culture as well. So, you know, you're having this kind of like fundamental shift in the makeup of this country with the most cultural influential, like culturally influential demographic groups in this country. The opportunity to affect change, not only at like, you know, kind of the product level, but also just like from a country competitiveness perspective, right? And preparing kind of folks in the demographic to be competitive in the way that like our world is leading us is one of the greatest opportunities of my lifetime. And I want to dedicate the rest of my life to that.
That's fantastic. And I know, I mean, speaking of the future generations, your that other half of you is dedicated to Code 2040.
Yeah.
You want to just kind of dive into that a little bit, maybe explain to the listeners what it is. And because there's a lot of youth coding STEM organizations, just kind of this new like tangential form of educating a younger population. But you also touched on the cultural makeup of the country and what it will look like in the future, which is steeped in the name Code 2040. So if you can just touch on that.
Yeah, bit, that'd be great. Absolutely. So, you know, Code 2040 really started on my story of like not knowing that Silicon Valley existed until I was 24. Right. Like that's a problem. Right. I had no idea what Silicon Valley was until I was 24. So like, how do we prevent folks like me who had the potential to really understand what this place is about, right? You know, I was a part of an organization in university is called Sponsors for Educational Opportunity. You know, their goal was to get the highest performing Black Latino undergraduates front office roles on Wall Street. You know, their value add was a lot of these Wall Street firms go to the Harvards and the MITs, but there are folks kind of that go to Stony Brook University like me who like have good GPAs and are hungry, who deserve the shot, right? So they extended the recruiting efforts of kind of these Wall Street firms. Silicon Valley's no different, right? You know, Silicon Valley recruits at a lot of, you know, the MITs, the Stanfords, the Carnegie Mellons. But what about the folks at Harvey Mudd or University of Maryland, Baltimore County or Stony Brook with folks with like 4.0 GPAs in computer science who want to learn more about this place? So, you know, we thought, much like SEO, Sponsor for Educational Opportunity, how do we develop a program to get the best and brightest minority engineering talent a shot out here, a shot to succeed, and over the next kind of 30 years or so, build the largest network of technical talent, happens to be Black and Latino, in the world.
Right.
You know, when you think about kind of, yeah, one book really had an effect on me. It's called Race Against the Machine. The premise of the book was pretty much, look, the gap between rich and the poor is as bad as it's ever been. It's only going to get worse. The reason is because people at the top are able to leverage tools to make them more productive, right? And this is just technology, which kind of reduces the need for them to have, you know, more employees and that sort of thing, right? But the folks at the bottom aren't leveraging technology in ways to make themselves more productive, right? So if we're going to kind of cross this chasm, and the view is like there's no middle class pretty much, so it's a bit of a kind of controversial view, but I believe a lot of the tenets to be right. If we are to kind of restore ourselves back to this middle class nation, almost have a new industrial revolution of sorts that's no longer analog but digital, kind of adoption of these tools and affecting of kind of like the way consumers interact with these tools is going to be more and more important. So the view that I had is, you know, in terms of what get the greatest economic opportunity, I think, is how do we make the greatest consumer demographic in the world be the best producer demographic in the world?
Right.
Right. Like that combination is actually pretty seismically like ridiculously awesome if someone could pull that off. In Code 2040, that's like when I think about the kind of larger vision and having the largest network of technical talent, that's really it. Our flagship program is the Code 2040 Fellows Program, where we get the highest performing engineering undergraduates internships out here and provide them with all the necessary tools to succeed. So we give them media training, we give them kind of mentors in their company and outside of them. They go to folks and speak directly with like the Ben Horowitz of the world, right? Or kind of Kleiner Perkins or any of these other firms around what it's like to just not only be a VC in the Valley, an entrepreneur in the Valley, et cetera. It's a 10 to 12 week program. And by the end of it, they're tired, right? Because we kind of give them a lot. But I think certainly rewarding. 90% of our fellows get full-time offers to come back, right? Most of our fellows come from the less traditional schools, right? So we've proven out a model that a lot of the kind of larger and smaller startups could not. And not only that, you mentioned earlier that there are a lot of organizations out there focused on things like STEM. But if you look at the undergraduate level, there's really nothing. Nothing.
Yeah.
And we really fill that gap at like four of the most formative years of one's life.
I think when you talk about like a bright future like that, right? There is also the meantime, and kind of a nod back to the Fast Company article, which I thought was awesome. And I read that and I go, like, I had so many Me Too moments, that article as far as the sociocultural economics that go into the spaces that we work in, right? Outside of here, I actually happen to run an innovations group for a fairly large media agency. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, Me Too, Me Too. Yeah. And if you see Top Five, like the scene with Kevin Hart and like on the phone, which is one, like it was like 3 minutes on screen. I'm like, Me Too.
Yeah.
There's this duality that has to, I don't know if it has to happen, but we feel like it has to happen. And one of my favorite quotes was in the article was from Kanye Macubela, who I met a few times. And he was like, I want to quote hip hop lyrics like Ben Horowitz does, in his tweets. And I'm like, maybe not. Do you experience that, and or how do you handle that?
You know,
duality?
It's funny. I used to think that, but now I just don't care.
Right.
I just don't. I think it's gotten to the point where I feel like I just fundamentally paid a lot of my dues, and continue to, right? I think I want to be judged by like the kind of output that I've had, and no one could question the amount of output that I've had so far, right? I just want to kind of live the life in the most authentic way possible, right? Like Walker Company is all about that authenticity, right? So I need to be like, if I like 2 Chainz, like I'm going to talk about 2 Chainz.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Like, it just is what it is. You know what I'm saying? that's what it is.
Right.
But like, and people can call out that, like, if they don't see that authenticity, they're going to call it out. I'd much rather be stuck in a world where people see me as authentic than not. Right. It took me a while to just not care what people think about me. Right. And Ben, like, really had to beat that in my head. He really did. Because, much like Kanye, I felt the same thing for a long time.
Yes. Well, I will tweet something really ignorant after after this interview. You will be appalled.
That's hilarious.
One last thing is... the idea of building a diverse team and innovation sparks from diverse perspectives in a room, kind of, I like to think of it as a culture clash of sorts. It doesn't have to be ethnically charged, but just experience and experiences. So I do know that you've built a pretty diverse team at Bevel and at Walker & Company. Maybe just walk us through a little bit of the thinking there, because, there's two trains trains of thoughts for me and probably in the world as well, where one is, yes, you want that diverse in, you know, the innovative outcome of diversity, but you also want the best people for the job. And, you know, there is a the process to fine tune that formula, especially in a world where it's not as diverse, and you can find talent that may not be as culturally diverse as you would want. So can just kind of walk us through like some of your design thinking around building the actual organization.
Yeah, so I don't think that those are mutually exclusive, right?
Right.
Like, there are enough qualified people. You just got to put in the work, right? A lot of people just aren't willing to put in the work, right? I mean, we have, well, there's 18 folks on the team, all of whom I really admire, all of whom are great at what they do, and all of whom I learn something from every single day. And we have one of the most diverse teams out there. We're majority minority, majority women, all of, like, really, really great leaders, right? You know, why is it the fact that I've been able to find that and few other folks have, right? I mean, it's not like I've done anything really magical to get there. I put in the work to do it, right? Like, I challenge all of kind of my immediate network to help me find diverse candidates to you know, potentially hire who will, like, excel at the role that we have, right? So it's up to it's a top down thing that has to happen in order to make that happen, and we've been able to do that successfully. Yes. And then secondly, like, I just believe in the science, right? At the end of the day, it's good business too, right? You know, and the science suggests that more diverse teams lead to more profitable businesses. I wouldn't want to swim upstream against that science, right? So it's imperative of me to expend time throughout, you know, my day-to-day to ensure we have as diverse a team as possible. You know, roughly 50%+ of my time is spent on recruiting anyway, so a large majority of that time should be spent on finding diverse folks, right? Like, there is no excuse.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I, you know, a couple of years ago, I was hiring for a position, and I kind of made a comment to myself. I was like, because all the resumes I was getting, I was like, there are a lot of white women out of work.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, and from an HR and legal perspective, like, you know, you want to, again, kind of filter through. But like you said, it's hard work to go make sure that you're covering all the ground you can, especially, you know, when you are building a team.
Well, I mean, there are things that you can do, like take off everybody's name off the resumes, right? You'd be surprised how much more diverse, like, your team gets.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? Like, there's just implicit bias that folks can't, like, I'm subject to implicit bias. Everybody's subject to implicit bias.
Right.
It's just imperative of people to implement processes by which they can mitigate that implicit bias. And very few people, well, I'm not going to overgeneralize, less people are willing to actually do what it takes to mitigate that implicit bias. And that's more laziness than anything.
That's true. I guess I'm lucky. My name is John Christopher.
See, it works.
See, I can get any job. So the show is called Innovation Crush. Obviously, I have a crush on you in some ways, in legal ways. And also, I'm curious as to what it is you're crushing on that you see out in the world right now that you look at as innovative. It can be in your space. It can be yourself. It can be, you know, cuisine. Anything that's kind of out there is kind of like, you know, makes your eyebrows raise a little bit.
Yeah. I'd probably say it's something, now that I have like a kid, right? Like, there are things that in terms of like my priorities that like I wish I could see more of that I don't see enough of. So like this like combination of like what's happening with wearables, right? You know, I still believe in that whole like childhood obesity thing and like this idea of play to like eliminate childhood obesity, right? You look at what the Xbox Kinect has done, what Dance Dance Revolution did way back in the day, and like a lot of people to like lose weight and that sort of thing. And, you know, I reflect back, you know, coming up as a kid, like wanting to play all the time, but a lot of kids that like I see these days don't want to do that as much, right? So, you know, how do we take technology exists today, all the sensors out there, and, you know, inspire that play for kids who can. But even I look at like my child, right, making sure that, you know, he's as healthy as can be.
Right.
Right. And there's very few things outside of my own paternal instinct, right, to help guide me. Right. And I wish there were more. And I'd be a pretty avid consumer of that stuff. Well, so I haven't seen too much, but like I hope that somebody would do it. And if you find anything, please let me know.
See, I told you when we talked before, I said you should come to CES. There was a ton of like baby stuff there. Baby wearables, awesome. Connected pacifiers. Awesome. So I will send you some links.
The issue is that like, you know, by the time that stuff comes out, my kid's going to be like 5 years old.
Meantime, just keep your fist balled up and keep your phone on you.
Yeah, exactly.
last but not least... can you complete this phrase for me? Innovation to me is.
That's a good question. You didn't tell me that before this
meeting. Hey, well, you know, you gotta surprise people at some point. Yeah, like I figured you've seen it all. I gotta get Tristan off guard a little bit. And don't worry about the lull. A lot of people get stuck with the like, well, let me see. So
I mean, the first word that came to mind, quite frankly, and I used this at my board meeting yesterday, was like paranoia, right? You know, if you think about like a lot of innovation, it's just driven by like ones being paranoid of like kind of what other people like could do.
Right.
So the first thing that came to mind to me was like, well, I don't know if it necessarily fits in the sentence, but like innovation is really, it's just driven by paranoia.
That's great. That's great. One of my favorite answers to the question was pancakes. And it was like,
that's awesome.
Our first series of recordings. We recorded like 5 shows in one day.
That's awesome.
I'm like, I'm going to try this new question out on everybody. And then she said pancakes. And I'm like, oh no, I shouldn't have done this. I was like, can you expand? And she's like, you know, it's a pancake is flat and plain, but you can make it whatever you want to make it. You can make it in different shapes. You can add different flavors, different color, you know, just all these different ingredients. And, you know, we all start with this sort of clean slate, and like the innovation comes in wherever your imagination takes you.
Yeah.
So I love that. So anyway, man, I wanted to thank you for joining us today. How can people find you in the world? What's your home address and well, what, I mean, what color I is your
share,
car?
I mean, I'm CW at walkerandcompany.com. Like, I share that with all our customers and everything. And then, you know, our products, getbevel.com for a shaving product, and then walkerandcompany.com to learn more about kind of like our, you know, overarching mission and all that shit.
That's great. And by the way, I shave and I like free stuff.
Awesome.
So thank you, Tristan. Everyone, this has been another installment of Innovation Crush. I am Chris Denson, and I thank you for listening. Talk to you next time.
Some major office supply stores are closing their doors, but Walmart has low prices on supplies you need to keep your business running smoothly. Like 2 packs of Papermate ClearPoint mechanical pencils on rollback for $4.77, 400 count Post-it notes cube on rollback for $3.97, and 25 yard Scotch heavy duty packaging tape dispenser for just $2.88. Plus, Walmart's got great prices on things like copy paper, printers, and more. For all your office supply needs, save money, live better. Walmart.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore, because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.